Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we take your pile of sources and unearth the most fascinating insights, giving you that aha moment without the information overload. I'm Jamie Murdoch, your guide, always eager to explore what makes our world tick.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm ready to delve into the nuances and hopefully bring some clarity to the complex.
Today, we're embarking on a comprehensive deep dive into The Economist, for the week of August 23rd to the 29th, 25.
Right.
We've got a formidable stack of articles here, touching on everything from global political shakeups to the absolute cutting edge of tech, and even how climate change is literally reshaping human lives.
It sounds like a busy week.
It is. Our mission, as always, is to navigate these waters, you know, extract the most crucial nuggets of knowledge, and really understand what they mean for you.
Absolutely. And this week's collection truly highlights the astonishing interconnectedness of global events. We'll explore how political decisions in one corner of the world can ripple across continents, how economic forces shape our daily lives in, well, sometimes surprising ways, and the subtle yet powerful social trends that reveal deeper changes in society. It's a week that really underscores how global dynamics are becoming, you know, ever more entangled.
Okay, let's unpack this. We're starting with a global political whirlwind, focusing on shifts in power and rising tensions across the map. Global political shifts and geopolitical tensions. First up, let's turn our attention to Bolivia's electoral shakeup. Our sources tell us that the ruling Socialist Party, which had been in power for nearly two decades.
A long time.
A very long time, was unexpectedly ousted in the first round of presidential elections. Neither frontrunner, the centrist Rodrigo Paz, nor the right-winger Jorge Quiroga, actually secured an outright win. So that means a runoff.
Okay, so a runoff. But that's not the whole story, is it?
Not at all. The real shocker. Spoiled ballots actually came in third place.
Third place. Wow.
Yes. And this seems to have been a powerful protest orchestrated by former President Evo Morales after he was barred from running. His party's official permitted candidate only managed to garner 3%.
That outcome immediately signals a profound rightward shift in Bolivian politics after, you know, two decades of socialist governance. But the truly telling detail, as you said, is that massive protest vote.
Exactly.
It's not just dissatisfaction. It's a coordinated act of political agency. It really demonstrates a populace willing to express profound disillusionment when their preferred leader isn't even on the ballot.
So what does that level of division mean for whoever wins the runoff?
Well, it raises immediate questions about any incoming leadership's ability to truly consolidate power and govern effectively. I mean, how do you lead when you have such a fractured and, frankly, vocal electorate?
So with that level of voter frustration, what's the biggest challenge for any incoming government in Bolivia then? They'll need to navigate the strong legacy of socialism, won't they? Particularly concerning natural resources and popular social programs.
Absolutely. The upcoming runoff is critical for determining the exact ideological direction. But that massive protest vote tells us any new government, whether centrist or right-wing, will start with a significant portion of the population feeling unrepresented.
Which sounds like a recipe for ongoing political volatility.
It certainly could be. And this situation, you know, it reflects a broader trend across Latin America where longstanding regimes are being significantly challenged. It connects to wider themes of public frustration and, well, sophisticated political maneuvering we're observing in various other regions, too, from India to East Africa, places where populations are increasingly finding ways to express political dissent outside traditional channels.
Okay, moving north now. Let's look at Canada's conservative comeback, or maybe a step in that direction.
Right. Perhaps tentative step.
Pierre Poilievre, Canada's conservative leader, won a parliamentary seat in a by-election in rural Alberta. He won it with an impressive 80% of the vote.
Which sounds decisive.
It does. But this victory was absolutely crucial for him personally, just to retain his formal role as opposition leader. Especially after his party's crushing general election defeat to Mark Carney's Liberals back in April. He'd actually lost his own seat then, too.
Yeah, what truly stands out here is that while this by-election win was, let's say, a political necessity for Poilievre, it doesn't just erase the memory of that wider general election defeat.
No, Definitely not.
It starkly highlights Canada's regional political divisions, you know, strong conservative support in places like Alberta, but struggling elsewhere. And the article points out that Mark Carney's appeal, especially his nationalist stance against Donald Trump's tariff threats and his strategic shift towards the political center, played a really significant role in the Liberal victory.
And Carney even pinched several parts of Poilievre's own platform.
He did. It's a classic political move, isn't it? Similar tactics used by figures like Tony Blair or Bill Clinton in the past to sort of broaden their party's appeal by occupying that centrist ground.
This strategic appropriation of policies is certainly interesting. So what does this mean for Poilievre now? He's facing a party leadership review in January.
Well, he needs to figure out how to expand the conservative vote beyond his base, doesn't he? Especially among younger Canadians and working class Canadians.
And the sources say that with the new Democrat slump, Canadian politics is becoming more of a two-party tussle.
Exactly. Which means the Conservatives can no longer really rely on a split progressive vote for victory. So Poilievre has to broaden his appeal.
Mm-hmm.
His critics suggest he needs to broaden his team beyond just, you know, political arena experience to find new paths, new ways to connect with a wider electorate.
And those policy shifts by Carney.
Yeah, the article explicitly mentions things like increased national defense spending, scrapping carbon taxes, cutting government departments, many of which were, as they put it, pinched from Poilievre's platform. It underscores a very deliberate effort by Carney to occupy that centrist ground. And while that's strategic for him, it presents a significant challenge for Poilievre to carve out a distinct identity that resonates broadly.
Okay, now for a development, that sounds like it's straight out of a geopolitical thriller. The U.S. military buildup in the Southern Caribbean.
Mm.
The United States is deploying significant air and naval forces. We're talking 4,000 Marines and sailors to the region. Officially, the reason given is to combat drug threats, and they've designated several gangs as foreign terrorist organizations back in February.
Right, the official line.
But the wider consensus, according to the sources, is that this buildup is also an attempt to rattle Venezuela's leader.
Yeah, the key insight here is the multi-layered nature of this U.S. strategy. On one hand, you have the framing as a counter-narcotics operation, which, you know, provides a legal justification for military action. But the designation of these gangs as foreign terrorist organizations significantly broadens the scope of potential intervention. It gives it a much wider geopolitical application.
So it's not just about drugs.
Well, the explicit goal of rattling Venezuela's leader signals continued forceful U.S. pressure on that country, whether that's because of its domestic policies, its regional influence, or maybe its global alliances. It's clearly sending a message.
What are the potential ripple effects of such a significant military presence in what's already a pretty sensitive region?
Well, this could easily escalate tensions, couldn't it? It might provoke a strong response from Venezuela or its allies, which could further destabilize the area.
And blurs the line.
It absolutely blurs the line between counterterrorism and state-level geopolitical pressure.
Mm.
And you have to wonder how other Caribbean nations perceive this. Is it protection? Or is it an unwelcome escalation of major power dynamics right in their backyard?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And this situation, you know, it aligns perfectly with a broader pattern we're seeing of heightened international tensions, where military, economic, diplomatic tools, all sorts of tools are increasingly used to exert influence. We see similar dynamics in Ukraine, in the Middle East. It illustrates a world where national interests are asserted through various means, often with a very real potential for escalation.
Shifting our gaze now to the Middle East, we confront the incredibly tense situation surrounding the Israel-Hamas ceasefire and Gaza offensive.
A deeply tragic situation.
It is. Hamas apparently accepted a ceasefire deal involving the release of 10 living hostages and the bodies of 18 more, in exchange for a 60-day halt in fighting.
Okay, a potential deal.
However, Israel is demanding the release of all 50 remaining hostages, about half of whom are thought to be alive.
Mm.
And crucially, Israel has begun its planned offensive in Gaza City, calling up 60,000 reservists.
Despite the potential deal.
And this offensive has met with widespread international condemnation. And tellingly, hundreds of thousands of Israelis have protested against their own government's decision to continue the war and its perceived failure to release the hostages.
What's truly heartbreaking here is the profound layering of conflict. You've got the direct confrontation between Israel and Hamas, obviously, but then there's a significant internal political struggle within Israel itself, the government, versus this distressed public.
And the international pressure.
And the international condemnation on top of that. The stark difference in demands for hostage release. It just underscores a fundamental disconnect in the negotiation terms. It makes finding common ground incredibly difficult.
So the Israeli government is proceeding despite massive domestic protest and international pressure.
Yes, and that decision speaks volumes about the weight of internal political pressures and perhaps strategic objectives that are outweighing calls for de-escalation right now.
Those domestic protests, though, hundreds of thousands of Israelis on the streets, that really highlights the immense internal pressure on the government, doesn't it?
It really does, and the implications are dire. This offensive is almost certain to worsen the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, deepen international condemnation.
And domestically.
Domestically, it suggests significant public dissatisfaction that could lead to serious political instability within Israel. And the precarious nature of any partial hostage release, even if it happens, just emphasizes how fragile and temporary any potential for peace is in this deeply entrenched conflict.
That sounds tragically familiar.
It tragically echoes conflicts like the prolonged Syrian crisis. It just illustrates how deeply entrenched disputes with their complex historical, political, social dimensions, they are incredibly difficult to resolve. The cycle of violence, fragmented leadership, external pressures, they often trap populations in these seemingly intractable struggles.
Okay, let's pivot now to a broader view of African instability and external influence, looking at cases in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mali.
Right.
Human Rights Watch is reporting that the M23 rebel group, which is reportedly backed by Rwanda, killed at least 140 people in eastern DRC just in July.
Despite peace agreements.
Exactly. Despite peace agreements brokered by America and Qatar. Meanwhile, in Mali, the former civilian prime minister appointed by the military junta, Tchogoko Kalamaiga, was jailed on embezzlement charges. It really underscores the fragility of civilian rule after that 2021 coup.
Yeah, the critical thread connecting these situations is the persistence of complex violence, often fueled by external actors and internal political infighting. The DRC case is a stark reminder of how regional powers can play proxy roles.
Undermining peace deals.
Absolutely. Peace agreements fail because the underlying issues, resource control, ethnic tensions, external interference, they're not truly addressed. And in Mali, the arrest of a former prime minister by the very junta that appointed him, well, that powerfully underscores the prevalent corruption and the consolidation of power by the military leadership. They're sidelining or purging former allies.
And there's this wider trend mentioned.
Yes, the source mentions a disturbing autocrats without borders trend across the continent, where leaders seem to be collaborating to suppress opposition, crossing borders to do so.
It sounds like a pretty grim outlook for stability in these regions.
It is. The implications are that this ongoing violence and political instability perpetuate immense humanitarian crises across the Great Lakes region in West Africa. It challenges the efficacy of international peace efforts when these underlying geopolitical interests aren't addressed.
And entrenches military rule.
Right. It further entrenches military rule in places like Mali, undermining prospects for democratic governance, and of course, deterring desperately needed aid and investment. These are clear examples of how deeply rooted issues undermine stability efforts, perpetuating cycles of violence and political upheaval.
Let's turn now to Syria's new political opposition. Ahmed al-Sharaa, Syria's new president following Assad's ousting, is apparently facing growing frustration and an emerging organized opposition, particularly coming from minority groups. This follows sectarian bloodshed in Latakia, an Alawite heartland, and Sawaida, a Druze-dominated province. The reports suggest government forces were slow or even unwilling to stop massacres there. And now a new coalition, the Syrian Centenary Initiative, is calling for constitutional reform and more scope for civil society.
Yeah, the truly critical development here is that the initial, perhaps naive euphoria after Assad's ousting has faded. It's been replaced by what the source calls creeping authoritarianism and a stark failure to ease sectarian divisions.
So Syria is becoming a tinderbox again.
It looks that way. The massacres, coupled with the government's feeble response or maybe even complicity, have profoundly eroded trust among minority groups. The emergence of an organized opposition, including veterans from the anti-Assad era, signals a real make-or-break moment for Sharaa's presidency and, frankly, for Syria's future.
So what's the immediate challenge for President Sharaa's leadership, then?
His response to this burgeoning opposition will define Syria's trajectory. I mean, tolerating or ideally actively incorporating these critics could act as a stabilizing force, potentially preventing another descent into civil war.
But his current actions suggest otherwise.
Well, his current actions, narrowing his coalition, relying heavily on former rebel group officials, stalling efforts to integrate minorities into security forces, they suggest he might lean towards repression instead.
Which could trigger more conflict.
It absolutely could. And, disturbingly, more foreign interference. Israel has already launched strikes after the Soweto atrocities. It's a very, very high-stakes moment for the country.
The article frames it as quite stark, doesn't it?
It does. Either Shura embraces an open constitutional process, deals constructively with the Kurds, broadens his leadership, or Syria risks another devastating cycle of internal strife. The weight of these leadership decisions in such a fragile post-conflict environment is just immense.
Okay, next let's explore Pakistan's role in counterterrorism and the distrust with the West. It seems Pakistan is actively collaborating with Western governments, particularly the U.S.
Mm.
They're working together to combat the Islamic State Khorasan Province, or ISKP, mainly in its borderlands with Afghanistan.
Mm.
ISKP is seen as a major international terrorist threat.
Right, a shared enemy.
Apparently, this cooperation even led to praise from Donald Trump after an ISKP planner was extradited to the U.S. Yet at the same time, Pakistan is seeking substantial U.S. support arms, intelligence, even the recovery of abandoned U.S. weapons from Afghanistan.
Right, the weapons left behind.
To use against its own internal insurgent groups like the Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistan, TDP, and Baloch separatists.
Yeah, the core insight here is the deeply complex and frankly often distrustful nature of this relationship. Pakistan is strategically leveraging its efforts against ISKP, a threat the West cares deeply about, to address its own pressing internal security concerns.
Using it as leverage.
Essentially, yes. And that request for abandoned U.S. weapons from Afghanistan's black market, that highlights the unintended, long-lasting consequences of past military withdrawals and the proliferation of arms in the region.
And the distrust is mutual.
It seems so. This mutual distrust is a constant backdrop. Pakistan subtly suggests covert U.S. backing for ISKP sometimes, while the West frequently questions Pakistan's intelligence transparency and its past links to other groups.
So what are the implications of this delicate diplomatic dance?
Well, this cooperation, while seemingly beneficial on the surface, is clearly driven by shared but ultimately distinct national interests. Any provision of significant military equipment by the U.S. to Pakistan could potentially strain relations with India, which is a much larger buyer of U.S. military hardware.
And the Trump factor.
The article suggests that the prospect of a second age of Trump, where established rules are often disregarded and the boss's whim is in, significantly influences Pakistan's calculation to draw closer to the current U.S. administration.
There was that White House lunch mention.
Exactly. Field Marshal Asim Manu's invitation to a White House lunch and subsequent talks underscore the diplomatic gains Pakistan seems to be making through this targeted cooperation, even amidst its own brief conflict with India earlier.
It's a prime example of pragmatism in international relations, isn't it?
It really is. Pragmatism often trumps historical animosity or ideological alignment, especially when confronting shared security threats. It also shows how external political shifts, like a potential change in U.S. administration, can profoundly impact regional alliances and strategies.
And speaking of regional shifts and pragmatism, it seems the world is slowly but surely learning to live with the Taliban.
A significant development.
4 years after seizing power in Afghanistan, the Taliban are beginning to break out of international isolation. Russia officially recognized them in July. China, the UAE, Iran, several Gulf states already have ambassadors in Kabul.
Even Germany.
Yes, even Germany has accepted two Taliban diplomats for, apparently, deportation coordination. And the Taliban hosted a trilateral meeting with China and Pakistan. This thaw is happening despite their abhorrent treatment of women and their strictly all-male Pashtun cabinet.
Yeah, the truly significant development here is this pragmatic shift in international policy. It seems driven much more by geopolitical and economic interests rather than a sudden change of heart on human rights concerns.
So practicality over principles.
It looks that way. Countries are prioritizing access to Afghanistan's mineral resources, critical counterterrorism efforts, especially against ISKP, and managing migration flows. Often these priorities are overriding previously stated conditions for recognition, like upholding women's rights or forming an inclusive government.
And the Taliban's position?
Well, the Taliban's own internal stability, their reported success in curbing corruption and poppy cultivation, and their efforts in suppressing ISKP internally. These give them a surprisingly strong hand in these diplomatic engagements.
The implications of this quiet recognition seem quite substantial.
They are. It grants the Taliban increased legitimacy on the global stage and provides them with greater access to international commerce, which inadvertently could undermine human rights advocacy efforts.
And the migration aspect.
Western efforts to return Afghan migrants also contribute to this engagement, even if it seems contradictory to stated values about the Taliban regime. We've even seen the U.S. lifting bounties on top Taliban officials and diluting sanctions. It all signals a pragmatic shift towards prioritizing security cooperation over full isolation.
That Taliban quote, "You have the clocks, we have the time," seems quite apt here.
It really does ring true, doesn't it? It suggests their long-term strategy of simply outweighing international pressure has, to a large extent, paid off. It raises a significant question. What does this say about the overall effectiveness of sanctions and conditional engagement as tools of foreign policy?
It suggests realpolitik often prevails, perhaps.
It suggests realpolitik often prevails when national interests diverge, and that sustained isolation is incredibly difficult to maintain in our globally interconnected world. The Taliban's resilience and their ability to provide a degree of internal stability, however authoritarian, has proven to be a compelling factor for many nations, forcing a reevaluation of engagement strategies.
Okay, let's bring it home to the U.S. now and explore domestic governance and the rule of law under President Trump, particularly concerning Washington, D.C. This section brings together several articles: the Jeffrey Epstein scandal documents, the deployment of National Guardsmen, D.C. being treated as Trump's chew toy, and the heckling of Vice President J.D. Vance.
Right, a cluster of related issues.
What's the connecting thread here?
The key insight, I think, is how deeply intertwined these events are with President Trump's approach to institutions, and specifically, Washington, D.C.'s unique constitutional vulnerability.
Explain that vulnerability.
Well, first you have the Jeffrey Epstein scandal documents. Their expected release shows that even years after his death, the scandal holds immense political power. There's an unyielding public demand for accountability that seems to transcend partisan lines.
Okay, and that's happening alongside.
Concurrently with the unprecedented deployment of National Guardsmen in D.C., ostensibly for crime reduction, but widely seen as a political maneuver. The article traces D.C.'s lack of voting representation back to a mutiny in 1783.
Wow, that far back.
Yes, which led to Congress gaining complete authority over the Capitol, ensuring it wasn't part of any state. This historical context illuminates why D.C. residents, who pay more federal taxes per head than any state, lack voting representation. It makes the city an easy target for federal power plays.
So Trump's actions are exploiting this.
The sources present his actions hyperbolizing crime, sending in the National Guard over the mayor's objections, temporarily commandeering police, dispatching masked agents, the DOJ investigating crime stats as an extreme, unprecedented weaponization of this longstanding vulnerability, and the subsequent public heckling of Vice President Vance underscores the pushback against these moves.
So what are the overarching implications of Trump's tactics regarding D.C. and these institutions?
Well, his methods, the hyperbole, the unprecedented use of presidential power, they seem to be compounding tensions rather than resolving problems. The article points out the mismatch between means and ends, like arresting someone for throwing a sandwich days after they had already been released.
Right, that example.
It erodes trust in law enforcement and local governance. This tactic of beating up Washington, which the article notes is irresistible for some Republican politicians, highlights how D.C.'s lack of full sovereignty makes it an easy target for political theater, often at the expense of its residents and the efficacy of its local government.
And the heckling.
The public heckling of the vice president just underscores a climate of significant political polarization and direct confrontation over these actions. It reveals a systemic issue where the city's unique constitutional status makes it vulnerable to political grandstanding, illustrating how historical decisions can have profound ongoing consequences, especially when exploited by powerful figures. Two, the global economy and tech landscape.
Okay, let's move on now to the global economy and the tech landscape. We'll start with a deep dive into Anglophone inflation's stubborn grip.
A persistent problem.
It seems so. Our sources reveal that while inflation is generally declining globally, it remains, quote, chronic in Anglophone countries. Britain, Australia, Canada, the U.S., especially when you compare them to EU and Asian nations like France or Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Britain, in particular, saw its annual inflation rise again, hitting 3.8% in July. That's the highest since January 2024. This stubbornness is apparently linked to larger budget deficits, high immigration in these Anglophone countries, and also tariffs in the U.S.
Yeah, the truly fascinating insight here is the emergence of this clear linguistic and perhaps policy-driven divide in inflation trends. The article uses an updated inflation entrenchment measure.
Okay.
Based on core inflation, labor costs, dispersion, expectations, Google searches a whole basket of indicators.
All right.
And it points to specific policy choices and structural factors in English-speaking nations that have fostered these persistently higher price rises.
Like what specifically?
Well, for example, larger budget deficits. An average 2% of GDP increase from 2022 to 2024 in Anglophone countries versus a contraction elsewhere. That significantly stimulated demand.
And immigration.
High immigration, while generally seen as beneficial long-term, may have, in the short run, pushed up prices, especially in things like housing. All this suggests that the Bank of England's earlier rate cut might have been, well, premature. Markets are now trimming bets on further cuts there.
So what are the implications of this divergence in inflation rates for people actually living in these Anglophone nations?
It means their central banks will likely be forced onto different monetary policy paths than, say, the ECB or the Bank of Japan. For consumers, it translates to a continued erosion of purchasing power and potentially longer periods of higher borrowing costs.
And the U.S. is an exception.
The U.S. is an interesting case. Immigration is declining there, but fiscal spending remains high, and the discussion around tariffs is fueling fears of further price increases, leading to quite high inflation expectations, 5.5% mentioned in the source.
So it really highlights the complex interplay of different factors.
Absolutely. Fiscal policy, monetary policy, immigration, global trade dynamics, they're all interconnected and shaping these macroeconomic outcomes. It makes inflation a far more complex challenge than often assumed. And this divergence links directly to discussions around Donald Trump's trade policies, as tariffs are a factor contributing to those inflation fears in the U.S.
And in stark contrast.
In stark contrast, you see Indonesia's central bank confidently lowering its main interest rate from 5.25% to 5%. They cite low inflation and strong economic growth, 5.1% annual rate in Q2, the fastest in 2 years. It's a clear sign of a very different, much more flexible economic trajectory compared to the Anglophone world right now.
That's a stark contrast indeed.
Okay,
speaking of innovation, let's talk about a significant development in digital finance, Japanese stablecoin approval.
Interesting.
JPYC, a Japanese startup, has won regulatory approval to issue a stablecoin pegged to the yen starting this autumn. Similar to dollar stablecoins, these yen-pegged tokens will be backed by stable assets, in this case, Japanese government bonds.
Which provides stability.
Exactly. And JPYC has ambitious plans. They aim to issue 1 trillion yen, that's about 6.8 billion U.S. dollars, worth of tokens over the next 3 years.
Yeah. The critical development here is Japan's decisive move into the regulated digital asset space. By pegging the stablecoin to the yen and backing it with highly secure government bonds, JPYC is clearly aiming to provide stability and confidence, differentiating it from more volatile cryptocurrencies.
And the scale.
That ambitious issuance target, 1 trillion yen, signals significant plans for widespread adoption and potential integration into the broader Japanese financial system. This could really position Japan as a leader in stablecoin innovation.
Offering a new avenue for payments.
Exactly. A new and potentially very efficient avenue for digital payments and financial transactions, maybe even streamlining cross-border payments eventually. It also suggests a regulatory environment in Japan that's increasingly open to digital currencies, provided they meet these strict stability and backing requirements.
Okay, a forward-thinking move there. Now, let's pivot to another institution facing pressure. The Federal Reserve under Trump's pressure.
Ah, yes, a recurring theme.
President Trump has extended his campaign against the Federal Reserve. Specifically, he's called for Governor Lisa Cook to resign, following accusations apparently from a housing agency head of falsifying bank documents to obtain a mortgage years ago.
And her response.
Mrs. Cook publicly stated she has no intention of being bullied to step down. Trump has also, of course, consistently urged the Fed to cut interest rates and criticized Chairman Jerome Powell.
What truly underpins this story is a direct, aggressive, and highly norm-breaking political interference in the independence of the Federal Reserve.
Targeting a specific governor.
Yes, the targeting of a specific governor with serious accusations, coupled with these broad public calls for immediate rate cuts. It clearly demonstrates a desire by the Trump administration to bend monetary policy to its political will rather than allowing it to be dictated solely by economic data.
And Mrs. Cook's defiance.
Her defiant stance highlights the crucial institutional resistance within the Fed. They're trying to protect their autonomy against such external pressures.
The implications of this kind of pressure seem quite severe.
They really are. This erodes the perceived independence of the Fed, which is absolutely crucial for maintaining market confidence and ensuring effective monetary policy long term.
And if it works, if the pressure succeeds.
Well, if successful, it could lead to policy decisions driven by short-term political gains rather than long-term economic stability that could potentially fuel inflation or create asset bubbles down the line. It also sets a dangerous precedent for future administrations, potentially weakening a fundamental pillar of economic governance.
And if it's a pattern.
Exactly. This aligns directly with President Trump's broader approach to institutions where established norms are frequently challenged and sometimes reshaped for political ends.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to trade wars and a fragmenting global order. We can bring together insights from the articles on Trump's trade policies and also Singapore's anxieties.
Right, they're very connected.
Our sources indicate that despite Trump's tariffs and arm twisting, many countries, including allies like Canada, Mexico, yep, but also BRICS nations, South Korea, they're hedging against America's unpredictable trade policies.
How are they hedging?
They're using subsidies, actively seeking new markets, and forging new alliances, often, interestingly, with China. What's striking is that China's exports to the global South have actually doubled since 2015, even as its exports to America collapsed.
That's a huge shift.
It is. And this has Singaporean elites feeling anxious and disappointed. They worry that this second age of Trump is undermining the rules-based global order that they thrived under for decades.
Yeah, the key insight here is the ironic consequence of Trump's America First trade strategy. It seems to be accelerating a significant shift away from America as the central axis of world trade.
So counterproductive.
In that sense, yes. Countries are prioritizing short-term fixes and longer-term alternatives. You see examples like BRICS nations now trading more with each other than they do with America. The biggest winner in all this appears to be China, which is cementing its role as a central trading partner for much of the global South and Southeast Asia.
And for Singapore?
Well, for a highly integrated, trade-dependent nation like Singapore, this uncertainty directly threatens its economic model. Their Prime Minister, Lawrence Wong, warned citizens to brace for turbulence, stating America is pulling back and weakening multilateral systems. It highlights the significant concerns of smaller, trade-dependent nations caught between these major power dynamics.
So what are the broader implications of this global hedging strategy for the world economy? Is globalization reversing?
It might not be reversing entirely, but this strategy of de-risking from U.S. influence could lead to a more fragmented, perhaps more multipolar global economy, one where political motivations and geopolitical rivalries increasingly guide investments and supply chains rather than purely economic efficiency. It challenges the very idea of a meritocracy in global trade.
And Singapore can't stop it.
Well, the article points out that even highly efficient nations like Singapore, a meritocrat's meritocracy, cannot unilaterally save globalization when major powers are deliberately disrupting the rules-based order. It leads to a more chaotic and less predictable environment for global commerce overall.
It really suggests a profound reordering of global economic power.
It does. Where geopolitical considerations are increasingly dictating economic flows and alliances, potentially leading to a less interconnected but perhaps more regionally focused global economy.
Okay, next, let's dive into the reshaping of the global chip industry. This is huge. We need to bring together the stories of TSMC's dominance, Japan's comeback, and Intel's struggles.
A critical nexus right now.
So TSMC produces two-thirds of all foundry chips, over 90% of advanced ones. They're powering the entire AI boom. NVIDIA, AMD, Apple, Microsoft all rely on them.
The undisputed leader.
Right. But they're embarking on what the source calls a tricky expansion beyond Taiwan, investing billions in fabs in Arizona, Japan, driven by land scarcity at home, an aging workforce, and crucially, geopolitical fears about Taiwan's vulnerability.
The China factor.
Exactly. Simultaneously, Japan is making a concerted push to rebuild its semiconductor industry with significant government support. There's even a new startup, Rapidus, that apparently achieved pilot production of cutting-edge 2-nanometer chips remarkably quickly.
That's impressive speed.
It is. And TSMC is also investing heavily in Kyushu, trying to revive Japan's Silicon Island. Meanwhile, Intel, once the leader, is described as being in turmoil. relying on TSMC for its most advanced chips, struggling against rivals like AMD, and facing this bold suggestion that it must break itself apart to recover its chip-making prowess.
Yeah, the key takeaway from this cluster of stories is that geopolitical risk and national security concerns are fundamentally reshaping one of the most critical industries in the world, semiconductors.
It's all connected.
Absolutely. TSMC's pure-play foundry model transformed the industry, but Taiwan's precarious position is forcing it into this risky global diversification. Despite higher costs, those Arizona chips are reportedly 20% more expensive.
In Japan.
Japan, driven by similar fears over Taiwan and a desire to regain technological superiority after falling behind decades ago, is making an aggressive strategic comeback. Rapidus's progress and TSMC's investment in Kyushu signal a very serious commitment.
Can Intel?
Intel, once the undisputed leader, has clearly fallen behind. Its historical integrated design and build model is now seen as a weakness in the current landscape. The suggestion that it needs to split itself into separate design and manufacturing entities, essentially mimicking TSMC's model, underscores the radical transformation required for it to compete again and, frankly, to reestablish U.S. technological sovereignty in this critical area.
So the entire chip ecosystem is being re-engineered due to these powerful forces. What are the broader implications of this massive high-stakes restructuring?
Well, the expansion by TSMC and Japan's re-entry aim for supply chain resilience, but they carry significant risks. Those overseas fabs are likely to lag behind Taiwan technologically for a while. A slowdown in the AI boom or increased tariffs could seriously impact TSMC's growth plans.
And for Intel?
For Intel, breaking itself apart would be a fundamental, radical overhaul. But its ability to eventually rival TSMC again has become a strategic national priority for the U.S. The stakes for Intel's future and for U.S. technological leadership could not be higher.
And the local impacts.
The economic benefits for places like Kumamoto in Japan, rising wages, soaring land prices, a boost to local economies illustrate the profound local impacts of these global strategic shifts. It's a massive global recalibration of manufacturing and innovation.
Let's turn our attention now to the cutting edge of cybercrime, AI-powered hackers, and the cybersecurity boom.
A scary combination.
Sounds like it. AI is dramatically broadening the reach of hackers, allowing them to create functioning malware, sophisticated deepfakes, highly personalized phishing attacks with unprecedented ease. Our sources even describe how ChatGPT was used to create malware.
Right, lowering the barrier to entry.
Exactly. And this alarming trend has, perhaps paradoxically, led to a massive boom in the cybersecurity industry. Corporate spending is predicted to rise by a staggering 25% to $240 billion by 2026.
Yeah, the core insight here is that large language models, LLMs, are making cybercrime both more accessible and significantly more scalable. It's fundamentally changing the nature of online threats.
How so?
Well, jailbreaking existing models like ChatGPT or using purpose-built criminal AI tools allows criminals to automate the creation of these highly personalized and effective attacks, spreading them more widely than ever before. And the source gives this chilling example of malware actually requesting LLM assistance from the cloud to help it break through network defenses. That's a terrifying new frontier in cyber warfare.
It sounds like an arms race.
It absolutely is an intense arms race.
So what are the implications of this AI-fueled arms race?
Well, for businesses, it means facing potentially huge costs. An estimated $40 billion in fraud losses by 2027 is mentioned. Yet this dark development also presents immense opportunities for cybersecurity firms.
Driving investment.
Exactly. It's driving a wave of acquisitions, Palo Alto Networks buying CyberArk and Protect AI, SentinelOne buying Prompt Security, and significant investment from tech giants like Microsoft with its Defender for Cloud, Google with Big Sleep, and its acquisition of Wiz. It creates this dangerous, rapidly escalating cycle between AI-powered offense and AI-powered defense. Innovation on one side directly drives innovation on the other.
It's a classic example of disruptive tech creating both value and risk.
Precisely. The cost of inaction for businesses is simply becoming too high.
Okay, next, let's explore AI startups. Dissenting views on valuation and performance. We've seen some recent market wobbles. Tech stocks like Palantir dropped 10%. NVIDIA shed $150 billion in value. CrewWeave's value fell by over a third after its IPO. While public tech valuations remain, quote, dizzying, new research by a professor named Jay Ritter is challenging the long-held notion that the new must be better than the old for startups.
Okay, how so?
His database of U.S. IPOs going back to 1980 shows that earlier startup vintages, like pre-dot-com ones, were actually more likely to go public They were smaller and, crucially, more profitable at the time of their IPO.
More profitable.
Yes, 60% were profitable versus only 24% for the new Webers. Newer vintages are also more prone to failure, 11% going belly up within 3 years of IPO compared to less than 6% for the pre-dot-com cohort.
So despite the historical data suggesting older, more profitable startups had better outcomes.
Right. Despite that, investors are continuing to reward newness and bigness rather than quality in the current AI boom. That's the critical insight, this apparent disconnect between the fervent market enthusiasm for new tech, particularly AI, and the underlying fundamental performance of many of these startups.
Which raises a red flag about the sustainability of current AI valuations.
Exactly. So what are the implications if this trend continues?
Well, it suggests a significant disconnect between market sentiment and fundamental performance. If profitable startups aren't seeing outsized gains in the public market, more might just choose to remain private. That could create a cycle of adverse selection where only the less fundamentally sound companies end up going public.
Which raises serious concerns.
Serious concerns about the sustainability of current AI valuations and the broader tech market. It draws some unsettling parallels to the dot-com boom and bust. The article warns that a bust could remove a sizable source of America's growth, just as the rest of the economy has begun to look fragile.
So history might be repeating itself, or at least rhyming.
It certainly offers a cautionary tale. Mm. It underscores the inherent risks of speculative bubbles and the importance of looking beyond the hype to fundamental business models and profitability, especially in these rapidly evolving technological sectors.
Okay, let's talk about a delicious problem now. Big chocolate's taste for lab-grown cocoa.
It's intriguing.
There's a severe cocoa shortage. Prices have tripled in 3 years. It's threatening the entire chocolate industry. Disease, climate change, poor farming practices are all blamed.
Right. The supply chain is under pressure.
Hugely. So in response, major chocolate makers, Lindt, Mondelez, Barry Callebaut, Meiji, they're investing heavily in innovative solutions, particularly cell culture technology for lab-grown cocoa butter and cocoa itself.
The key insight here is how the extreme scarcity of, as the article calls it, the food of the gods, is forcing an entire industry to seek these radical alternatives. Lab-grown cocoa offers a potentially promising solution to these supply chain vulnerabilities and the impacts of climate change.
And the process itself.
Well, the process of growing plant cells is described as cheaper and easier than cultivating animal tissue for, say, lab-grown meat. And because it's an ingredient, lab-grown cocoa might face less political or consumer opposition than lab-grown meat has. This represents a really significant potential pivot for a multi-billion dollar industry.
The implications sound huge. Could this really revolutionize the chocolate industry?
It could, ensuring a stable, potentially more ethical supply of cocoa, and maybe addressing many of the environmental concerns associated with traditional cocoa farming. The significant investment by these major players suggests a strong belief in its commercial viability and its ability to crack even complex products like dark chocolate.
It's a fascinating example of innovation driven by threat.
Absolutely, driven by both existential threats to supply and also potentially growing consumer demands for more sustainable and ethical products. It's pushing the boundaries of what's possible in food production.
Okay, next, let's look at China's economic wobble and shift to services. The Chinese economy has followed what's described as a three-act drama.
Right, the pattern.
Strong starts, mid-year wobbles, and then year-end stimulus. To hit its 5% growth target this year, new consumption-focused stimulus measures have been introduced. Things like childbirth subsidies, free preschool, elderly care vouchers, subsidized consumer credit for cars, education, tourism.
So a shift towards boosting consumption.
Exactly. The fascinating aspect here is China's clear pivot away from its previous intense focus on high-tech manufacturing and its Made in China 2025 initiative, which ironically led to market flooding and what the source calls involutionary competition, basically overly intense, self-defeating competition within certain sectors.
So they're changing track.
Yes. The government is now explicitly recognizing that people now spend more on services than they do on goods. This is leading to a strategic reorientation towards the service sector. These new measures are designed to directly boost household consumption and also address pressing demographic challenges, falling birth rates, aging population. It signals a significant ideological shift in their economic planning.
What are the implications of this shift?
Well, while these novel consumer transfers are currently quite small and each less than 0.1% of GDP, apparently, they signal this significant ideological shift towards prioritizing consumption as a driver of growth, not just investment and exports.
But there are challenges.
Yes. China faces long-term challenges like Baumol's cost disease, where services tend to become relatively more expensive over time, potentially dragging down overall growth. And the article notes China faces unique constraints in its service sector due to state dominance in areas like banking and telecoms and tight regulation.
So can this pivot work?
Well, the article speculates that embracing services, despite the cost disease challenge, could eventually narrow the GDP gap with America and potentially make China number one by finally addressing its long-neglected tertiary sector. It's a high-stakes gamble, attempting to rebalance its economic model in the face of these profound demographic and global trade shifts. The success of this pivot will really define its future economic power. Okay, a few shorter business updates. First, the Air Canada strike ends.
Good news for travelers.
Yes. Flight attendants at Canada's largest carrier ended a three-day strike after union leaders successfully reached a deal. A key provision of the new deal is that Air Canada will now pay attendants half their hourly rate for boarding passengers, a task that was previously unpaid.
That's significant. It highlights the enduring power of organized labor to secure better working conditions and fairer compensation. Paying for boarding, that represents a major win and directly addresses a common grievance across the airline industry. It could set a precedent.
Okay, next, let's examine BlackRock's $11 billion deal with Saudi Aramco.
A huge deal.
BlackRock, the massive American asset manager, struck an $11 billion deal to lease natural gas facilities from Saudi Aramco and then, interestingly, leased them back to the state-owned energy giant for 20 years. This is part of Saudi Arabia's broader strategy to attract foreign capital.
Right, diversifying away from just oil revenues.
Exactly. BlackRock's already been pouring significant cash into other infrastructure deals there.
The critical insight here is how this large-scale deal demonstrates Saudi Arabia's strategic imperative to diversify its economy, attracting substantial foreign investment. For BlackRock, it aligns perfectly with its growing interest in real assets and these long-term lease agreements.
And the leaseback structure.
That arrangement is particularly clever. It allows Saudi Aramco to monetize existing assets, injecting capital into the business, while importantly retaining operational control over those facilities.
What are the implications here? We're talking natural gas facilities, Saudi Arabia.
Well, the deal signifies a continued deepening of economic ties between major Western financial institutions and Saudi Arabia. Despite potential criticisms related to climate change concerns, it is natural gas or ongoing human rights issues. It underscores the intense global competition for capital and the strategic importance of infrastructure investments in shaping international economic relationships. It's a complex interplay of finance, national development, and geopolitics.
Okay, next up, a story of impressive diversification from China, Xiaomi's diverse growth.
They make more than phones now.
A lot more. Xiaomi's overall revenue rose by an impressive 31% year-on-year in Q2, even though its core smartphone earnings dropped slightly. What's truly remarkable is its electric vehicle unit.
Right, the EV business.
It significantly narrowed its losses from 500 million yuan down to 300 million yuan, and it's now expecting to turn a monthly or quarterly profit by the end of this year.
That's incredibly fast progress. This beautifully illustrates Xiaomi's successful and rapid diversification strategy, particularly its impressive progress in the highly competitive EV market. Narrowing losses so significantly and targeting profitability by year-end, that's an exceptional feat for a relatively new entrant. It proves their adaptability and broad market appeal.
What are the implications? Could they challenge Tesla, BYD?
Xiaomi's emerging success in the EV sector could certainly pose a significant challenge to established players, both in China and potentially globally. It could accelerate the transition to electric vehicles. Their ability to effectively leverage their powerful brand and manufacturing prowess across diverse tech sectors positions them for sustained growth and increased market influence. It's a testament to how fast Chinese tech companies can pivot and innovate.
Shifting gears completely now to a unique cultural phenomenon. Popmark's Labubu dolls soar.
Ah, the Labubu craze.
Exactly. Sales of these smiling elvish trinkets drove Popmart's net profit up by a staggering 400% year-on-year in the first half of 2025.
400%.
Incredible. And what's even more impressive is that 40% of these sales were abroad. The Chinese toymaker shares have risen by nearly 250% this year, making it worth more than Mattel and Hasbro combined.
Wow. The key insight here is how this is an extraordinary example of a cultural phenomenon translating into massive global commercial success. The worldwide craze for these collectible dolls demonstrates the immense power of design, the allure of limited edition collectibles, and crucially, highly effective marketing to create incredible value, even surpassing long-established industry giants like Mattel and Hasbro.
What are the implications of this success?
Pop Mart's meteoric rise shows the dynamic nature of consumer markets. It shows the potential for new brands, especially those leveraging collectibles and social media trends to disrupt established industries. It also reflects a broader shift in consumer preferences towards unique, expressive, and collectible items, often driven by social media and a desire for personalized expression. Culture can translate into immense financial success.
Okay, now for a humorous yet maybe thought-provoking. Look at the future of collaboration, the last days of brainstorming.
The Bartleby column.
Right. It humorously depicts a typically chaotic human brainstorming session, which contrasts sharply with the final suggestion from a latecomer who simply used ChatGPT for ideas. The AI apparently honed the list, worked up some taglines, and did a trademark search, all very efficiently.
Yeah, the critical insight from the satirical vignette is how effectively it highlights the increasing, and probably inevitable, role of AI in creative and strategic tasks. While traditional human brainstorming is often portrayed, perhaps unfairly sometimes, as messy and inefficient, AI offers a structured, rapid, comprehensive approach to idea generation and initial validation.
So the humor underscores potential obsolescence.
I think it subtly underscores the potential obsolescence of some traditional brainstorming methods as these AI tools become more sophisticated and deeply integrated into our workflows.
What are the implications then? Is human creativity doomed?
Not necessarily doomed, but perhaps transformed. The piece implicitly suggests a future where AI becomes an indispensable assistant in ideation, handling much of the legwork, the initial filtering of ideas, thereby allowing humans to focus on higher-level creative refinement, strategic selection, maybe the emotional intelligence aspect. It raises compelling questions about the very definition of creativity and the evolving nature of collaborative work in an increasingly AI-augmented world. 3. Societal shifts and human impact.
Okay, let's turn now to some pressing societal shifts and human impacts, beginning with climate change. Direct and unequal impacts. This brings together several articles on pregnant women and rising temperatures, the situation in New Orleans, Andean skiing, and European wildfires.
A sobering collection.
It is. Our sources highlight that pregnant women are particularly vulnerable to higher temperatures. Studies show a 4% increase in preterm birth odds for every 1 degree C rise in the month before birth. And these impacts critically exacerbate existing inequalities, like for Black mothers in California or women in the Gambia.
Right. Health impacts are not evenly distributed.
Meanwhile, New Orleans, 20 years after Hurricane Katrina, remains defiant and precarious. Facing rising waters, a sinking city, despite massive federal spending, $125 billion post-Katrina. Industries are losing jobs, residents are leaving.
And the skiing.
The Andean ski industry, which had seen a resurgence of interest from international skiers, is now literally melting away. A 19% decline in average snow cover per decade is reported, and Europe is warming faster than other continents, leading to record-breaking wildfires. Though, interestingly, 57% of known fires are deliberately lit arson.
Yeah, the unifying insight here is the deeply personal, unequal, and often human-driven reality of climate change. It's not some distant threat. It's directly impacting the health of the most vulnerable, like pregnant women.
And costing lives and capital.
Absolutely. With projections of significant rises in child mortality and preterm births in Africa, for New Orleans, it's this paradox. An incredibly expensive project that begets more projects requiring continuous subsidies, prompting a national debate about subsidizing vulnerable cities versus strategic retreat, especially as other U.S. cities, Miami, L.A., Phoenix, become increasingly vulnerable too.
And skiing and fires.
The melting Andean ski industry shows how specific leisure activities and local economies are directly threatened. And while warming creates the kindling for European wildfires, the crucial detail is that human actions, arson for land clearing, underinvestment in prevention often provide the match. It reveals a profound governance problem alongside the environmental one.
That's a powerful and grim assessment of how varied these impacts are. What are the broader implications then?
They necessitate urgent research into the biological mechanisms, like those affecting pregnant women. critical national debates about how we support or potentially retreat from vulnerable cities. They highlight significant threats to local economies dependent on climate-sensitive tourism. And they demand multifaceted solutions, both environmental, addressing global warming, and policy-driven, tackling everything from arson penalties to forestry management and land use policies. This isn't just about global temperatures. It's profoundly reshaping human lives and the choices we have to make.
It's a critical intersection of so many fields.
Public health, urban planning, economics, environmental crisis, revealing how climate change is a present danger with deeply personal and societal consequences that demand immediate, integrated, and often politically complex solutions.
Let's transition now to issues of migration policies under strain, focusing on Cubans in Florida and Britain's asylum situation.
Two very different contexts, but similar pressures.
Cubans in South Florida, who once enjoyed unique immigration privileges under the Cuban Adjustment Act of 1966, a Cold War relic.
Right, special status.
Now face the same uncertain status as other Latin American migrants due to Trump administration policies. Documents like the I-220A and the lifting of humanitarian parole programs are making permanent residency incredibly difficult. Deportation to third countries like Mexico is increasing.
A dramatic shift for that community.
It is. Meanwhile, in Britain, a court ruling regarding the use of a specific hotel, the Bell Hotel in Epping, to house 138 male asylum seekers is threatening to disrupt Britain's entire asylum policy. The local council argues using the hotel this way is a material change of use requiring planning permission, which the Home Office disputes. All this while small boat migrant arrivals have increased by 50% over the last year, nearing an all-time high.
Yeah, the key insight here is how deeply rooted immigration policies, even decades-old exceptions like the Cuban Adjustment Act, can be rapidly dismantled or challenged by new administrations or legal rulings, creating immense uncertainty and hardship for the affected communities.
The contrast for Cubans is stark.
It really is. From honored exiles symbolized by Miami's Freedom Tower facelift to facing harsh facilities and fear of deportation. In Britain, that legal dispute over a hotel's change of use dramatically underscores how even seemingly mundane administrative issues become incredibly complex and politically charged when linked to sensitive immigration matters. They're caught between rising arrivals and intense local opposition to housing solutions.
So what are the implications of these shifting and strained migration policies?
Well, in the U.S., it marks a fundamental shift, dismantling that Cold War era exception. It's creating fear and indignation among Cubans who, the article says, now feel they are treated just like Mexicans. Miami's immigration court is swamped.
And in Britain.
A court ruling against the Home Office could severely complicate the government's ability to house asylum seekers, adding further strain to an already, quote, broken planning system and inevitably increasing costs. Both situations reveal this contentious environment where central government policies clash fiercely with local community resistance, making these incredibly difficult issues to navigate politically and practically.
It reveals how quickly policies change and the human impact.
Absolutely. A stark reminder of the human impact of shifting political winds and the complex interplay of national and local governance in managing migration flows.
Okay, next, let's explore a darker side of globalization. Grand Theft Global Inc. The New Geography of Stolen Goods.
This sounds like a movie title.
It does. Expensive consumer goods, cars, phones, even high-tech farm equipment like tractors and their GPS kits are increasingly being stolen in wealthier countries, particularly Britain is highlighted. And then they're exported to distant markets, places like Africa and China, via highly sophisticated global supply chains.
So organized crime gone global.
Very organized. Britain, in fact, apparently accounts for 40% of stolen phones in Europe, yet its police solve only 5% of these crimes.
Only 5%. Wow. The critical insight here is how this is presented not just as theft, but as a global business with all the hallmarks of legitimate commerce, specialist service providers, seamless communications, incredibly efficient markets.
And distance helps them.
Yes. The concept that distance is a feature, not a bug, is particularly telling. It ensures stolen goods reach places where they cannot be easily traced or recovered. Exports are rarely checked thoroughly. Containers make auditing incredibly difficult.
And the impact on trust.
The impunity of thieves, coupled with the fact that these same gangs are often involved in violence and drugs, yet police apparently don't categorize these thefts as high-harm crimes, that severely corrodes public trust in law and order.
What are the implications of this Grand Theft Global?
Its success represents a troubling dark side of globalization, using its very infrastructure, shipping, communication, markets for illicit ends. It exposes significant vulnerabilities in the export controls of wealthy nations and highlights critical resource limitations within police forces.
And it might spread.
The article ominously predicts that this criminal model will likely spread from Britain to other countries, posing a growing challenge to international law enforcement and cooperation. It's a powerful and disturbing counter-narrative to the idealized vision of frictionless global trade.
Turning to India now, we have serious concerns being raised about India's election fairness questioned.
A fundamental issue for any democracy.
Indeed. Rahul Gandhi, India's main opposition leader, has alleged a vote chori, which means vote theft, scheme by the ruling BJP party in last year's general election. He cited thousands of irregularities.
What kind of irregularities?
Some sound quite bizarre. Houses numbered zero, households with 80 registered voters, even Dafortgaiv listed as a registered voter's name. Gandhi has openly accused the Election Commission of India, the ECI, of collusion with the BJP.
Right. The critical point here is that these allegations, whether ultimately proven or not, raise fundamental questions about democratic integrity in India, especially given the ruling BJP's dominant political power since 2014.
And the Election Commission's role.
The article highlights how the ECI's neutrality is seen as critically compromised because its head is nominated by a panel that is skewed towards the executive, essentially favoring the ruling party. This stands in stark contrast to an earlier era of coalition politics in India, where the political dynamics actually incentivized the ECI to maintain strict neutrality to be seen as a fair arbiter.
What are the implications of these allegations?
Even if dismissed by the BJP, they significantly undermine public trust in the electoral process and democratic institutions. The Supreme Court had recommended that the Chief Justice of India be included on the nomination panel for the ECI head to ensure more balance, but that recommendation was subsequently ignored by the government. That highlights a concerning power imbalance. This situation represents a critical challenge to the health and the perceived fairness of Indian democracy.
It points to potential institutional erosion.
Indeed. A concerning trend where institutional independence appears to be weakening, raising significant questions about the long-term health and credibility of democratic processes in the world's largest democracy.
Okay, next, let's discuss a troubling regional trend identified in the sources. East African governments colluding to stifle dissent.
Autocrats without borders, as the article puts it.
Yes. Recent cases, a Ugandan lawyer arrested in Tanzania, a Ugandan opposition leader apparently kidnapped in Kenya, other critics being seized across borders, strongly suggest that security forces in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda may be actively colluding to crush dissent across their national boundaries.
The key insight here is the emergence of this deeply disturbing regional trend. These governments appear to be cooperating to suppress opposition, often through methods like unlawful rendition, reported torture, and abduction. The high level of coordination mentioned between these security agencies reflects a concerning convergence of authoritarian tactics across East Africa.
What's driving this?
Possibly driven by the unpopularity of some leaders domestically and a palpable fear of popular uprisings spreading across borders.
The implications sound dire.
They are. This erosion of human rights, the rule of law, and regional stability is profound. It challenges the traditional idea of neighboring countries acting as safe havens for dissidents, and it raises serious questions about the effectiveness of Western efforts to promote democracy. As the source chillingly notes, authoritarians across the continent are discovering just how much they can get away with.
And there are political undertones mentioned.
Yes, the fact that Kenyan President Ruto apparently apologized to Tanzania after one incident involving a Ugandan activist, alongside his alleged personal bond with Uganda's President Museveni, underscores the complex political dynamics potentially enabling this regional suppression. It's a troubling illustration of how authoritarian regimes are finding new ways to collaborate and consolidate power.
Moving to East Asia now, let's examine Hong Kong's courtroom dramas and judicial independence.
A closely watched situation.
The high-profile trial of pro-democracy media tycoon Jimmy Lai, accused of sedition and colluding with foreign forces, really highlights the sweeping changes to Hong Kong's legal landscape. These come under the National Security Law, NSL, imposed by Beijing, and the more recent locally enacted Article 23 legislation.
And Lai's prospects.
He faces life imprisonment, and the article states flatly, "Few observers doubt that the 77-year-old will be found guilty."
Right. The critical insight here is how China's promise to preserve Hong Kong's common law system after the 1997 handover is being severely tested, if not frankly, outright dismantled. The NSL introduced these sweeping, fuzzy categories of crime that were previously unknown in Hong Kong law.
And Article 23.
Article 23 has toughened sentences further, making it far easier to jail dissenters. While Hong Kong still ranks relatively high in some global rule of law indices overall, its specific score for fundamental rights has plummeted dramatically from 33rd down to 62nd. That's a clear indicator of the erosion of core civil liberties.
What are the implications for judicial independence?
They're profoundly concerning. The near 100% conviction rate in NSL cases is one major red flag. Another is the departure of prominent foreign judges from Hong Kong's top court, like Lord Sumption from the UK, who resigned citing the political environment.
So judges are under pressure.
Judges are now operating in what the source calls ill-charted territory. They face immense pressure to be patriotic, as defined by Beijing, and to accept the Communist Party's ultimate monopoly of power. This risks a serious erosion of the judiciary's strength and independence. You might see the best lawyers avoiding judicial appointments, leading to a system that, while retaining some superficial common law forms, ultimately yields politically predetermined outcomes in sensitive cases.
There was a quote from a judge mentioned.
Yes, Lord Sumption quoted a very senior judge in Hong Kong saying, regarding the pressures they face, we have nowhere else to go. It poignantly encapsulates the difficult, perhaps impossible, realities faced by Hong Kong's legal professionals trying to uphold the rule of law under these new conditions. It's a stark example of political control systematically undermining legal autonomy.
Okay, next, let's reflect on COVID-19's political and economic aftermath. Two recent books reviewed argue that the pandemic led to a global surge in inflation, a significant breakdown of trust in experts, and a serious aggravation of political polarization.
The long tail of the pandemic.
Lockdowns, initially inspired by China's approach, were implemented globally. But they often hurt the poor more than the rich, and fueled partisanship, particularly in the U.S., with Democrats generally supporting lockdowns and vaccines, and Republicans often opposing them. The argument is that the science frequently focused narrowly on disease minimization, often ignoring the broader societal trade-offs.
Yeah, the critical insight here is how the pandemic stress-tested institutions worldwide. It revealed both remarkable successes, like the incredibly rapid development of effective vaccines, and profound failures, such as public health authorities' perceived overconfidence or inconsistency, and some governments suppressing dissent or alternative viewpoints.
And the emergency power.
The implementation of the greatest mobilization of emergency powers in human history often led, according to these books, to bad policies vigorously applied. A stark example given is schools remaining closed much longer in Democratic-run states in the U.S., causing significant, measurable educational and future earnings losses for children.
What are the implications of this analysis?
Well, the rapid shift in messaging, for example, from shaming people for being in the street protesting lockdowns to shaming them for not being in the street protesting after George Floyd's death exposed a deep hypocrisy for many and fueled public distrust. A feeling akin to gaslighting.
So it deepened divisions.
The pandemic ultimately bred partisan rancor, intolerance, and bad policies, with the authors arguing that red and blue politicians and voters retreated into cocoons of self-righteous certainty. The crucial lesson, they suggest, is the urgent need for a more honest politics of crisis policymaking, one that acknowledges uncertainty, admits mistakes, and respects the reasonableness of differing viewpoints on complex trade-offs.
It's a powerful reflection on how a global crisis can expose deep societal fissures.
Absolutely. And it highlights the critical importance of transparent, nuanced leadership in times of profound uncertainty. The long-term effects on trust in institutions and political discourse are clearly still unfolding.
Now, for a topic that touches on the very essence of ideas in free speech, censorship and publishing, that book is dangerous.
A provocative title.
It is. Adam Stella's book argues that something silly is happening in publishing. He points to 2,452 titles targeted for censorship in U.S. libraries just in 2024. This isn't just about controversial new books. It includes things like trigger warnings being added to classics like Orwell's 1984 and the Baudelaireization, the editing or censoring of Roald Dahl's children's books.
So, sensitivity overriding original intent.
That's the argument. Satella contends that the solution to a perceived lack of diversity or potential offense has become worse than the problem, leading to conniptions, cancellations, and the absurd strictures of sensitivity readers.
What's the underlying cause, according to the book?
The key insight offered is how the rise of online platforms, email, social media, has significantly lowered the barriers to entry for the argument industry. Replacing thoughtful commitment or debate with instant 2 minutes hate rituals, as Orwell might say, publishers fearing intense online backlash often lack the resources or will for robust fact-checking, even for books presented as true stories. This creates a climate where sermonizing is in fashion, leading to the suppression or modification of books that dare to disturb or challenge conventional viewpoints. What are the implications of this trend?
It risks undermining intellectual freedom, stifling diverse viewpoints, and promoting a conformist literary landscape where challenging or uncomfortable ideas are actively suppressed or watered down. The author argues that silence in the face of this makes one guilty too, advocating strongly for speaking out against such censorship.
It raises fundamental questions about literature's role.
Indeed. Is it primarily to comfort or to challenge? And what is the responsibility of institutions, publishers, libraries, schools, to safeguard intellectual freedom against the pressures of digital outrage and shifting sensitivities?
Let's turn to a fascinating intersection of pop culture and politics in Britain. What BOSH means for British politics.
Ah, yes, Tom Skinner.
Tom Skinner, a reality TV star famous for his catchphrase, BOSH, has surprisingly become, according to the article, a guide to a country that politicians seem to struggle to understand. Right-wing figures, including strategist Dominic Cummings and even the American Vice President J.D. Vance, are engaging with him. They see him as a symbol of the white van man working class.
So politicians are looking to reality TV for insights.
It seems so. The key insight here, according to the analysis, is how Skinner symbolizes a desperate political class out of ideas, grasping onto digital flotsam whatever's trending online for relevance in a rapidly changing media landscape. He simplifies class, making him an accessible, if perhaps inaccurate, figurehead for politicians struggling to connect with voters whose job prospects are increasingly threatened by things like AI.
And his use of AI.
His admission that he uses ChatGPT to turn his garbled Essex prose into synthetic poetry for political influence is presented as a profound, almost McLuhan-esque observation on modern media, authenticity, and communication. What are the implications of this trend?
It suggests that this trend of celebrity politicians and digital native communicators bypassing traditional media reflects a profound shift in political engagement. But Westminster's monomania, their obsession with one particular type of voter, treating Skinner as Albion incarnate, risks ignoring the complex realities of BOSH Britain, a country that, as the article says, contains multitudes.
And the example is quite telling.
Yes. The visual of Skinner eating lasagne for breakfast on Instagram contrasted with a senior politician awkwardly squeaking BOSH for a social media video. It vividly portrays the performative and often cringeworthy nature of this particular style of political outreach. It shows how traditional establishments are struggling to adapt.
Okay, let's wrap up with some modern living and cultural phenomena, starting with the intriguing world of young American female soldiers of TikTok, or hashtag MILTOK, as it's apparently known.
Right.
As the number of male active duty members in the U.S. military declines, their female counterparts have risen by 12% since 2005. And TikTok's niche, featuring, say, lieutenants doing skincare routines or Navy officers documenting nursery runs, is surprisingly helping to recruit soldiers.
Even though Congress sees TikTok as a national security risk.
Exactly. These women, the sources clarify, are not part of some official PSYOPs campaign. They genuinely want to be heard within the institution, sharing their experiences authentically.
The critical insight here is the unconventional and perhaps unexpected role TikTok is playing as a recruitment tool for the U.S. military. It's leveraging social media to appeal to a younger, more diverse audience, showcasing a more relatable and modern image of military life than traditional recruitment ads might.
But it also reveals tensions.
Yes. It also reveals the internal tensions within the military regarding women's evolving roles. The article mentions Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's somewhat shifting views and the persistent reality of gender discrimination, with 13% of active duty women reporting they experienced it in 2023.
What are the implications of this? It sounds quite paradoxical.
It is paradoxical. The military's reliance on an app that Congress considers a national security risk creates a significant internal conflict and highlights a disconnect. But these female influencers are actively shaping perceptions of military life. They're challenging traditional notions of masculinity in the armed forces and advocating for their legitimate place within the institution, even if, as one influencer apparently put it, it's through silly means necessary.
So bottom-up culture change.
Exactly. It shows how bottom-up cultural shifts, facilitated by new technologies like TikTok, can challenge and eventually reshape even the most rigid and traditional institutions. It highlights a generational and gender-based transformation happening within the military.
Next, let's discuss Marjorie Taylor Greene and the cloud seeding conspiracy.
This story.
A startup called Rainmaker used drones to conduct cloud seeding operations in Texas. 2 days later, tragically, a deadly downpour hit Kirk County nearby. This sparked immediate social media theories blaming the cloud seeding technology.
Connecting two unrelated events.
Precisely. Republican politicians, including Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, quickly propagated these fears. Greene even proposed the Clear Skies Act to ban weather modification entirely, calling it a felony to release chemicals into the atmosphere for such purposes.
Yeah, the key insight here is how this is a classic example of technological innovation, especially one involving complex environmental processes like cloud seeding, immediately fueling conspiracy theories when combined, purely coincidentally, with an extreme weather event.
Even though science says otherwise.
Right. Despite a clear scientific consensus that cloud seeding on that scale could not possibly have caused the extreme rainfall observed, the narrative of government plus aircraft plus altering weather patterns resonates powerfully with pre-existing chemtrail beliefs and is easily weaponized for political grandstanding.
The implications seem quite dangerous.
They are. This creates a perilous intersection of misinformation, public fear, and legislative attempts to ban scientifically unproven threats based on conspiracy theories. It actively undermines public trust in science and contributes to a climate where verifiable facts are easily dismissed in favor of politically convenient narratives. The article even mentions physical threats and vandalism against the company, highlighting the very real-world dangers such rhetoric can incite.
It's a stark reminder of how quickly science can be distorted.
Absolutely. Distorted and politicized in an era of rapid information dissemination and deep political polarization.
Moving south now, let's explore Mexico's love affair with Japan and Korea.
A fascinating cultural exchange.
Millions of Mexicans have apparently developed a deep affection for Korean pop, K-pop, Japanese anime, and also the languages, food, and fashion of both countries. This cultural import has spurred a massive 60% increase in travel to Japan for Mexicans in 2024 alone, 150,000 visitors. And simultaneously, there's been a huge surge in Korean cultural exports, the phenomenon known as Hallyu, or the Korean wave.
So what's the insight here? How did this happen?
The critical insight is the incredible power of soft power and cultural exchange in shaping international relations and consumer trends. Mexico became an early regional hub for dubbing Japanese anime into Spanish, which cemented strong Japanese cultural ties from quite early on.
And Korean culture.
Korean culture, with its younger appeal, strong K-pop and K-drama presence, and savvy use of social media, has built powerfully on this foundation. The article notes different motivations exist too. Interest in Japan might be more linked to work opportunities or traditional culture, while Korean interest is often driven by passionate pop culture fandom, especially among younger women. What are the implications of this cultural boom?
These booming cultural imports are significantly deepening Mexico's relationships with both Japan and South Korea. It's fostering not just cultural appreciation, but also expanding trade ties. There's been a Japan-Mexico free trade agreement since 2005, and South Korea and Mexico are exploring new ties. It even boosts diplomatic efforts.
And China's influence.
Interestingly, while China is making inroads in Mexico for economic pragmatism, things like job prospects, its soft power, there is described as more of the boardroom than the bedroom wall. It highlights a key difference in how cultural influence versus economic influence is exerted and received. It's a vibrant illustration of cultural exchange creating deep connections.
Okay, let's discuss a success story in public health now. Mpox in Sierra Leone. A model for Africa.
Good news is always welcome.
Sierra Leone effectively combated an Mpox epidemic in 2024. The key, highly effective public health messaging, notably by engaging trusted local figures, market women, religious leaders, traditional healers. This stands in stark contrast to other countries in the region that are still struggling with the outbreak.
So community engagement was crucial.
Exactly. What's puzzling scientists, however, is that the recent strain, known as Clade II, spread faster than previous strains, and unusually infected both sexes equally. The pattern is different.
Right. The critical insight here is that Sierra Leone's success provides a powerful example of the importance of tailored, community-led public health strategies, especially in low-resource settings. Engaging those trusted local figures for public health messaging proved far more effective than generic, top-down approaches often favored elsewhere. It shows a deep understanding of local social structures and communication channels.
But can this model be copied everywhere?
That's the caveat. While Sierra Leone offers a valuable model, its lessons aren't necessarily fully transferable to all contexts. There are significant differences in country size, conflict status, and previous outbreak history. For example, the DRC is massive in dealing with ongoing conflict, while Nigeria battled Mpox for years before this recent wave.
And the puzzling nature of the virus.
The unusual spread pattern of this strain indicates ongoing scientific uncertainty about the virus itself. It underscores the critical need for continued research and highly adaptable responses to emerging and evolving health threats. It highlights the importance of context-specific interventions and reminds us viruses can change.
Next, let's delve into a fascinating controversy surrounding a best-selling book, The Salt Path Controversy, Truth in Memoir.
Ah, yes, the book about walking the coast path.
Exactly. Rainer Wynn's memoir, which was lauded internationally as unflinchingly honest, has now been exposed by journalists for apparently containing numerous invented or exaggerated details. These relate to her homelessness, her husband's serious illness, corticobasal degeneration or CBD, and her financial woes. There are even allegations she stole £64,000 from a friend.
Wow, quite the expose. The critical insight here is that this scandal raises fundamental questions about the veracity of memoirs and the often lax scrutiny applied by publishers. Many publishing houses lack dedicated fact-checkers, especially for nonfiction narratives presented as personal experience.
But the book was incredibly successful.
Massively successful. Its success, despite what the article calls its constant grumbling tone, suggests that readers were deeply drawn to its uplifting message of redemption through nature, finding solace in the wild, even if that message was built, it now seems, upon significantly fictionalized elements. The poor me's lament, as the source puts it, resonated powerfully.
What are the implications of this controversy?
Well, it has caused suffering of its own, according to the report, particularly for actual CBD patients and their families who were given potentially false hope by the husband's supposed dramatic recovery depicted in the book, which seems to have been greatly exaggerated.
How are readers reacting?
While some readers are understandably angry about the fabrications, others, perhaps surprisingly, don't seem to mind as much. They appear to value the theory or the emotional impact of the story over strict factual accuracy. This really challenges the publishing industry's ethical responsibilities and potentially damages public trust in the entire genre of true stories or memoir.
It underscores the complex relationship between author, publisher, and reader.
Absolutely. Highlighting how emotional truth can sometimes be prioritized, consciously or unconsciously, over factual accuracy with significant ethical repercussions down the line.
Okay, let's discuss a pop culture icon now, Sex and the City 2, and just like that, Carrie Bradshaw's legacy.
End of an era, perhaps?
And just like that. The sequel series recently concluded, marking the end of Carrie Bradshaw's journey that began with Sex and the City. Carrie was described as an infuriating yet influential heroine who broke ground by tackling topics previously unaddressed on TV. However, she was often criticized fairly, perhaps as spoiled and judgmental.
And a sequel.
While And Just Like That attempted to fix some of Sex and the City's original shortcomings, particularly its lack of diversity, the consensus seems to be that it never recaptured the charm or cultural impact of the original.
Yeah, the critical insight here is how Carrie Bradshaw became such a potent cultural icon despite, or maybe precisely because of, her many flaws and her often implausible Manhattan lifestyle. Sex and the City was genuinely groundbreaking for its time, openly addressing female sexuality, relationships, friendships in a way that hadn't been done before on mainstream TV.
But the reboot struggled.
The sequel, And Just Like That, attempted to modernize and diversify, reflecting current social debates. But it visibly struggled with its central characters, their storylines, and finding a compelling narrative arc. It highlights the immense difficulty of evolving beloved characters for a new generation while trying to preserve their original appeal.
What are the implications? What's Carrie's lasting legacy?
Well, Carrie's influence on fashion, on internet memes, on a continuous stream of think pieces that persists long after the original show ended. The transition from Sex and the City to And Just Like That vividly reflects the challenges of rebooting beloved cultural touchstones for new sensibilities and expectations. It highlights that inherent tension between nostalgia and contemporary relevance.
In our connection to fictional characters.
It also shows how deeply viewers can connect with fictional characters, making, as the article says, breaking up with a fictional character so hard. It's a powerful illustration of the enduring impact of popular culture and the complex, often emotional, relationship audiences form with these narratives over time.
Now for a truly mind-bending study, psychedelics and the clergy. a Johns Hopkins study.
This one caught my eye.
This research involved giving psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, to 29 psychedelic naive clergy members from diverse faiths. Priests, rabbis, imams, Zen Buddhists.
A diverse group.
Very. The results were astounding. 96% ranked the experience among their top five most spiritually significant moments ever. And 42%, nearly half, called it the most profound experience of their entire lives. Participants reported deeper connections to their faith and improved prayer practices even a year later.
What's the scientific explanation offered?
The critical insight relates to the brain's default mode network, the system involved in self-reflection, rumination, our sense of self. Psychedelics temporarily alter or quiet this network. By disrupting it, psilocybin allows for new ways of thinking and can offer therapeutic benefits, which is why it's being studied for depression and PTSD, and for the clergy.
For the clergy in this study, it led to direct, often universalist, encounters with the divine. Described in various ways, experiencing God as a dog, seeing a harp-playing woman, or simply feeling overwhelming love. Very personal, intense experiences.
What are the implications of this for religion?
They're significant. This challenges traditional notions of faith as solely or primarily a product of discipline, doctrine, and ritual. It poses a potential challenge to religious institutions that sometimes seek to contain spirituality within prescribed dogma.
Because of the universalism.
Yes, the universalism apparently promoted by psilocybin, the feeling that it's likely to broaden one's faith beyond specific doctrines, might deeply bother religious authorities who promote their own faith as the single superior path. However, advocates argue that these substances could be seen as a conduit to the very mystical experiences described in many scriptures, offering a new lens through which to understand ancient spiritual texts and practices.
It raises profound questions.
Absolutely. About the nature of spiritual experience itself. Is it solely a product of traditional practice, or can it be accessed or perhaps triggered through other means? This study really challenges established boundaries and invites a re-examination of spirituality in the modern world.
Okay, next let's talk about a surprising fashion trend in China. China's hottest new look, the facekini.
The facekini.
Right. Designer sun protection facekinis, essentially. Full face covering masks, often extending down the neck, are becoming incredibly popular in China, especially among younger consumers. This trend has evolved from being cheap beachwear, primarily for older women. Now, companies like Ben Under and major sportswear brands are cashing in.
But the government isn't keen.
Apparently not. The Chinese Communist Party does not approve, lamenting what it calls sun protection anxiety.
The critical insight here is how this trend, which was likely broadened by the widespread mask wearing during the pandemic, reflects deeply ingrained cultural preferences in China for fair skin, and also a heightened awareness of sun protection, particularly among women. It's a unique blend of fashion, health consciousness, and potentially a subtle form of personal expression or even conformity. It indicates a shift in what constitutes desirable aesthetics and self-care in modern Chinese society.
What are the implications of the CCP's disapproval?
It's quite interesting. Branding it as sun protection anxiety suggests a desire by the state to control cultural narratives and potentially curb what they perceive as excessive or perhaps non-conformist trends, even in fashion. This raises questions about the extent of state control over even seemingly innocuous personal choices and how the government attempts to influence consumer behavior and broader societal norms. It's a small but telling example of that push and pull.
Let's turn our attention now to an innovative solution for a growing global problem. AI-powered robots for electronics recycling.
A much-needed innovation.
Definitely. In 2022, 62 million tons of e-waste were generated globally. That waste contained an estimated $63 billion worth of recoverable raw materials, yet only 22% of it was actually collected and properly recycled.
A huge waste of resources.
Exactly. Now, new AI-powered robots are being developed specifically to efficiently disassemble complex electronics, phones, laptops, etc., sorting the valuable components before the rest is crushed or shredded. We're seeing examples like Apple's Daisy robot, which can dismantle over 20 different iPhone types, Microsoft developing one for hard drives, and Germany's Fraunhofer Institute working on a more general-purpose system for diverse e-waste.
So why is AI the key here?
The critical insight is that manual disassembly of modern electronics is incredibly labor-intensive and complex. Traditional robots, the kind you see on car assembly lines, struggle with the sheer variety and intricate nature of e-waste. AI provides the breakthrough. It allows robots to recognize and take apart the thousands of different devices that end up in the waste stream, adapting to different models and components. What are the implications? Is this the solution to e-waste?
It's a huge step forward. This technology is crucial for recovering those valuable raw materials, copper, gold, cobalt, rare earths that are currently lost to landfills or inefficient recycling processes. This reduces environmental impact and addresses resource scarcity. It also encourages firms, potentially nudged by increasing legislative pressure like right to repair laws, to design products with end-of-life management and disassembly in mind.
How soon will we see these robots widely used?
Well, a commercial multi-purpose robot capable of handling all sorts of e-waste is still perhaps 5 years away, according to the source. But in-house solutions developed by manufacturers like Apple are emerging faster. It represents a major step towards creating a genuine circular economy for electronics, truly making products useful in death as they were in life. It's a powerful example of AI solving complex environmental challenges.
Okay, next, let's tackle a question many of us ponder at our workplaces. Standing desks. Benefits vary with age.
The standing desk debate.
While proponents often claim standing desks improve cardiovascular health, boost attention, and reduce back pain, the research actually shows pretty mixed results. A review focusing specifically on university students found they might reduce anxiety and improve mood, but there was only weak evidence for back pain relief or metabolic benefits in that age group.
And for older adults.
A broader review, looking across different age groups, did find notable benefits for lower back pain in about half of the 17 papers reviewed. But again, only weak evidence for cardiovascular health benefits. No notable differences were found in blood pressure, VO2 max, glucose, insulin, or mood in that broader population.
So the science is more nuanced than the hype.
Exactly. The critical insight here is that the science behind standing desks is clearly more complex and less conclusive than often presented in marketing or popular articles. The increase in heart rate while standing is described as middling, about 7.5 to 13.7 beats per minute faster, and that doesn't consistently translate into clear metabolic or cardiovascular gains in most studies.
But the back pain finding seems consistent.
Yes. The consistent finding across several reviews is the reduction in lower back pain, especially, it seems, for individuals past university age. That indicates a specific, rather than a universal, health benefit. So, what's the takeaway for the aching desk jockey listening? Should they get a standing desk?
The advice seems to be nuanced. While standing desks cause no significant harm, their benefits might be quite age-dependent and primarily related to back pain. They're probably not a panacea for all health issues associated with sedentary work, but they can offer targeted relief for that specific problem. It calls for a more nuanced understanding of their utility, moving beyond sweeping claims.
Right. Manage expectations. Finally, let's delve into a meta discussion within economics. Economists disagree about everything, don't they?
The classic joke about economists.
Lay two economists end to end. But the article argues that the Trump era, surprisingly, has ushered in unprecedented unity among economists on certain core issues like the benefits of trade, the value of immigration, and the dangers of politicizing monetary policy.
So they agree on some big things.
Yes. However, fault lines still remain. Disagreements persist on novel issues where data is scarce, like predicting AI's long-term impact on GDP or the future stability and role of stablecoins, and also in areas involving complex trade-offs, like antitrust enforcement or financial regulation.
What's the evidence for this consensus?
The critical insight comes from the University of Chicago's Clark Center for Global Markets, which regularly polls a diverse panel of leading economists on topical issues. These polls reveal strong consensus on things like the benefits of free trade, the effectiveness of Pigouvian taxes, like carbon taxes, and against policies like interest rate caps or rent control. They largely rebuke Trump's specific economic policies.
And the disagreements.
Disagreements predominantly arise where those trade-offs are genuinely complex market power versus efficiency in antitrust cases, or financial stability versus economic growth and regulation debates, or where novelty creates significant uncertainty because the data just isn't there yet. The 100% agreement condemning bias in the Bureau of Labor Statistics after Trump fired its statistician is given as a powerful example of rare united consensus against political interference in data. So what are the implications for how we should listen to economists?
It suggests that policymakers and the public should pay close attention to expert consensus where it clearly exists, as it's typically backed by extensive research and strong evidence. However, we must also recognize areas of genuine uncertainty, especially concerning new technologies or complex societal trade-offs. In those areas, careful consideration of multiple perspectives and potential consequences is paramount. As the article concludes, economists are often only as confident as the data let them be.
It highlights the scientific nature of economics.
Indeed, confidence is correlated with data availability. Where there's genuine uncertainty, it requires humility and a nuanced approach to policymaking, rather than dogmatic adherence to any single viewpoint.
And lastly, a look back at a life well lived. Terence Stamp obituary, actor and philosopher.
The true icon.
Terence Stamp, the 1960s film icon, passed away at 87. He was renowned for his intensely strange and mesmerizing acting style, but apparently preferred philosophy and inner exploration over the trappings of celebrity. He sought to be absolutely present in the moment in his acting.
Influenced by Krishnamurti.
Deeply influenced by the philosopher Jiddu Krishnamurti. Stamp later spent 7 years living in an ashram in India, embracing yoga and meditation.
Yeah, the critical insight here is how Stamp's unique acting method, exemplified by that famous one-take scene in Billy Budd, apparently driven by recalling a specific childhood memory, aimed to bypass intellect and connect directly with the audience through raw feeling, a presence beyond just thinking or technique.
And his life journey.
His remarkable journey from being a Cockney film star, a face of the swinging 60s, to seeking spiritual enlightenment in an ashram in India. It highlights a truly fascinating personal quest for pure consciousness and energy. It reveals a man deeply committed to inner exploration and then applying their spiritual principles directly back to his craft.
What are the implications of his life story? What can we take from it?
Well, his life challenges the conventional pursuit of fame and external validation. It suggests there's a deeper, perhaps more enduring value in inner exploration and self-awareness. His ability to apply his spiritual practice to his craft, enabling him to tackle incredibly diverse roles like playing a transsexual woman in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, demonstrates a remarkable integration of philosophy and profession.
And the macrobiotic diet.
And his enduring, almost ageless beauty, which he attributed partly to a strict macrobiotic diet, just adds a touch of quirky, almost legendary discipline and self-care to his story. It's a beautiful example of how an individual's personal philosophy can deeply inform and elevate their professional work. True artistry emerging from self-discovery.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into The Economist for the week of August 23rd to the 29th, 25.
Wow.
What an incredible journey through the complexities of our world this week, from shifting political landscapes to the cutting edge of technological innovation.
It really covered a lot of ground.
As we wrap up, what's one thought you hope listeners carry with them from this week's edition?
I think what truly resonates here, looking across all these disparate stories, is how often the big picture issues, you know, climate change, geopolitical rivalries, technological disruption, manifest in deeply personal and sometimes really unexpected ways.
Right, like the pregnant women or the chip engineer.
Exactly. Or even the fashion choices in China with the face bikini. It powerfully reinforces that understanding global events isn't just about absorbing headlines. It's about tracing those threads that connect directly to our individual lives, our communities, and the collective choices we make.
Which raises a question.
It does. It raises an important question for all of us, I think. In a world where these global forces feel increasingly overwhelming, how do we best balance the urgent, understandable demand for immediate solutions with the perhaps more difficult, patient pursuit of deeper understanding and the long-term fundamental changes that are truly necessary to address these complex challenges?
That is a powerful thought to leave you with. This deep dive has certainly offered a rich tapestry of those connections, reminding us that knowledge is always most valuable when it's understood, connected, and applied. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Thank you.
We hope you feel a little more well-informed and perhaps a lot more curious. Until next time, keep asking those big questions.